many months before the beginning of this war, signed a pact to defend themselves. This is more or less the official formulation, which has been published on internet, it is possible to see on internet, calling for such a kind of military exercise named Southern Mistral 2011. And in this document it is written that the military action from the part of France and Great Britain should be engaged between March 21st 25. That means we have in this military exercise the full description with 4 months in advance of the aggression against Libya. That means all the argumentation according to which the intervention has been done for humanitarian reason is completely false, and it was a pretext. But I would like to add that there is no one rule in the international law giving authorization to intervene militarily against a state for humanitarian reason. Probably somebody would like to have this rule, but till now this rule does not exist, and probably it would be very good, very interesting if the General Assembly of the United Nations will discuss the introduction of this rule, but this rule has to be very attentively, very seriously examined and approved. And we have not any approval of this kind.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, 93.5 Unity FM. You just heard a clip from Voice of Russia Radio, which is actually via the Shortwave Report, which is a podcast which you can download from outfarpress.com every Friday. And it's well worth listening to. We'd like to thank Dan Roberts for that as well. For that clip, and of course Voice of Russia Radio, an Italian journalist and ex-European MP who was disputing the figure of 10,000 people massacred by Colonel Gaddafi, as reported by Al Jazeera, amongst other things. Now, Russia, of course, have been a voice of dissension, basically, against what's happening in Libya. I personally think they've been quite sensible about it, and you know, what they put across is just very sensible points, and just saying, look, let's be realistic about this. Let's be honest. I mean, if you say that you're doing this along the, you know, the, how you say, basically, this UN resolution, 1973 resolution, then really we should be sticking to it to the letter. I'd like to bring in our weekly correspondent from Bristol Community FM, www.thisweek.org.uk, Tony Gosling, on this conversation. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Tariq. Nice to have you back.
Nice to have you back too, Tony.
Yeah, the this is a bit of a bombshell, isn't it? This particularly what Giulietto, I mean, he was actually, I mean, let's just understand who he was precisely. He used to work for Rai, which is the national Italian TV, a bit like our BBC, as a foreign correspondent. I think he was their correspondent for the old Soviet Union and Russia during the transition and Glasnost and all that. But anyway, he then went on to become, that voice we just heard, to be a member of the European Parliament. And, yeah, what he's saying there, I mean, amongst all the other things, is pretty incredible. I think the lesson here is a salutary lesson, really, which is that the coverage that we're getting here in the UK really is only showing one side of the story. We're only getting the one side, which is really rather worrying. I think it's important that, you know, any kind of national news reporting on an issue like this has got at least some balance in it. I don't think anybody expects your national media to be 100% balanced when there's a struggle where people's, you know, a country's armed forces are involved in the struggle. But we've seen really quite an extreme one-sided coverage of the Libya conflict so far, and this has not been reported. This is a great, another one of those great behind-the-headline moments, Eric, I think you'll agree, where it's been now discovered that last autumn there was an exercise, the Mistral exercise planned, a joint exercise between Britain and France, led by the French, to simulate an aerial attack, a bombardment of Libya, including a UN Security Council resolution that would allow it, and actually starting almost on the same day as the attack on Libya started. around about the 20th of March this year. Now, I'm sorry, but that to me is, you know, it's not coincidence, because I have, you know, a friend of mine who was trained at Sandhurst as an army officer. He told me that when he was doing his training, they did a simulation of an attack, a war game, of an attack on a saucepan-shaped island in the Mediterranean. And within 3 months or so of him, this was one of the last things he did. Wargaming is quite an important thing of the officer training. And he was quite gobsmacked to see on the television that the that Cyprus had been invaded just after he'd been doing this wargaming. So I think it's pretty clear that these wargames and exercises are being used as a way to actually gear up for real war.
Well, it's like
we've seen this also in North Korea, of course, where the war games in the end of last year nearly led to an armed exchange between the two. Well, it did lead to an armed exchange.
North and South Korea, yes. I mean, that was threatening to blow over, didn't it? I mean, luckily and hopefully it actually settled down a bit now.
And the big story we're not hearing on Libya is the use of depleted uranium by the United States and by the British. I mean, this is the most effective weapon of choice by the Western NATO countries for tank busting, because these depleted uranium shells are very, very good at busting through the steel armour and the various types of armour that there are on modern tanks. But the trouble is, they leave a horrendous radioactive toxic legacy for literally hundreds of thousands of years in the soil and in the water of the countries where these weapons are used. I mean, in my view, that these weapons should never be used.
Well, I was under the impression, Martin, and sorry, Tony, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe under the United Nations resolution that use of depleted uranium or white phosphorus is actually illegal.
Well, this may be why the British press is not touching this story. I mean, I think, yeah, we're seeing a very, very biased reporting of what's been going on in Libya. Also, as Giulietto pointed out there is nothing in the UN Charter that permits countries to intervene in internal civil squabbles. The UN Charter, which was put together after the Second World War, and which includes the lessons learned in the Second World War, was absolutely clear. It is not permissible for one country to intervene in a civil struggle going on inside another country.
Well, I also was under the impression that, and I believe, if I'm correct, that under the United Nations Resolution 1973, that we are not allowed to arm either side, whether it's the rebel or the pro-government supporters.
That's quite right. And it looks to me as if this 1973 resolution is simply a Trojan horse in order to start the snowball rolling towards another long, protracted war, rather like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, I think that's what we're going into. And I was saying to the lads just to start the show, the declaration or the article that was written by Nicolas Sarkozy and Barack and David Cameron last week. It was on Sky News, so they did quite a lengthy discussion on that. I think it's Wednesday or Thursday. That, I mean, at the start of the war, all three sides said, we're not going into Libya for regime change, but we're going in to protect the civilians that Gaddafi is supposed to be massacring. However, last week, when the declaration was actually written up by Sarkozy and Cameron, it actually stated that we are going to bomb Libya until Gaddafi actually goes. And to me, that is another way of saying we're not going to come out until Libya, until we have a change of regime.
The irony of all this, Saeed, is that actually what's going to happen, and what's already happening, is as the people of Libya see that the West is breaking the rules here, is doing things like using these, at least potentially anyway, using these depleted uranium shells, it is actually going to be driving more and more of the Libyan people into the arms of Gaddafi. They will see him as the victim and the West as the aggressors in the future.
Well, absolutely. It's like, we've gone into Iraq, we went into Afghanistan. Just going back a few weeks, we've seen the horrible incident and the retribution that was carried out in Afghanistan. And again, I have to say, all sectors were actually united.
I'll tell you something aside, and to everyone listening, I mean, I won't mention names, but I have a good friend who's Iraqi and who lived in Iraq during the period of Saddam Hussein's rule in Iraq. And he gives you a very different perspective to what we have heard about Saddam Hussein as a person and his policy towards, for instance, the famous incident of the gassing in Halabja. He gives you a very, very different perspective on this. What he's saying, and bearing in mind that he lived there, you know, he was there at the time of all this happening, is that the two rebel leaders of the two rival Kurdish factions arrived in Halabja. This is his what he's telling me. And he also says that they met with Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein has said to tell your people that, you know, they should go, they should move from here, basically. Or initially, he'd actually offered them to have Kurdistan as a sovereign country, and they had actually refused. After this, they appeared in Halabja. Saddam Hussein warned them prior that he was going to carry out this gassing, basically, but they failed to tell their people. Whether that's true or not, I'm not trying to say that, you know, this is verified fact or anything, but this is one of the words of
an Iraqi
himself.
It's very, very interesting, isn't it? And how we actually made Saddam, I mean, by no means Saddam was an angel, but it seemed that how we demonized Saddam Hussein
What it does tell you is that sometimes the media tells you one thing, but you will meet people who were there and who were present, who were certainly nearby. One could argue that maybe he lived in Iraq and that, you know, he was prone to the propaganda being actually no doubt broadcast over the Iraqi media at the time. Who knows? I'm not going to try and delve into that. The fact is, we have a different story. We have a conflicting story.
Mm. Well, again, just coming back to the present day, to the present time, I'm coming back to Libya. We already, I think, starting to notice that the support for the Western intervention are starting to deplete, because not only Gaddafi is taking casualty, and I'm sure Tony will correct me if I'm wrong, but NATO are now striking rebel forces as well. Whether it's accident or not. I mean, it's been reported in the main media that rebels have been taking casualty from NATO airstrikes.
No, you're absolutely right. This has been happening quite a lot. Quite whether this is all by mistake or quite whether there's some sort of design behind it to at least trying to remove... I mean, there was this famous case last week where a load of tanks which had just been captured by Gaddafi's forces were then destroyed from the air by NATO. You know, this is, you can imagine how dispiriting that is for the rebels, where they've just risked life and limb to capture some tanks, done it successfully. They're on the making their getaway with these tanks, and then they find themselves blown to pieces from the air by their allies.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, you know, Tony, in all this, is on one hand, we're actually blasting the hell out of Libya, and, you know, in Ajdabiya. You know, there's Gaddafi forces are advancing. Now, I mean, NATO's job was to actually keep the Gaddafi forces at bay, but they're not doing that well at all. And I say, Tariq, the support for the Western intervention is starting to deplete, because rebels are taking more casualties now. They have been for the last couple of weeks by NATO's airstrikes.
Well, there's something else here, actually. I mean, we just talked about Iraq a minute ago, and I'm sure Tony has seen the cover of The Independent today. And basically there's some secret memos, an expose of secret memos that have been leaked from around the period of 2002, just prior to the invasion of Iraq, where meetings took place between BP, Shell, and with Tony Blair, another representative of the government at the time, where they were basically carving out oil deals. Now, of course, Tony Blair is denying this and quashing its conspiracy theory. But once again, it seems like history may just be repeating itself here.
Well, yeah, I haven't actually seen that from today's Independent, but it doesn't tremendously surprise me. I think everybody realises that there is actually a plan for a kind of Middle East, for various moves in the Middle East by NATO and the Western countries. It's just that the only way that this plan can actually unfold is if these various troubles in these various countries are seen to be something which are grassroots uprisings. If it was, sort of the narrative in the Western world was that this was a plan to invade, take over the Middle East, eventually to attack Iran, I think this would be very unpalatable to Western public opinion. And I suppose it's a simple, you know, sort of a cover, really. You know, the cover story, the idea being to sort of just try and make sure that people feel that these kind of interventions are okay. I mean, we hear today that they're now putting what they call, in inverted commas, advisors in. Now, we know that the Special Forces, MI6, have been working in there already from all the various reports of strange helicopters arriving and certain rather embarrassing moments where British advisors were taken prisoner by the rebels. And I think the rebels are now on the back foot in the battle with Gaddafi, and so they're much more prepared to accept people from outside, and I think they're much more likely now to, if some Western helpers, advisors, appear, then they're much less likely to be arrested at gunpoint now because the rebels are on the back foot.
But also, I mean, there is that little story going on that the British SAS are now on its way into Libya to train and arm the rebel faction in eastern Libya.
I mean, I think, you know, most of the insider commentators are saying that the SAS are in there already, despite the fact that there isn't really, you know, the wording of the UN Security Council resolution doesn't really allow for that. It's saying no occupying force. Well, I suppose they would say, well, we're not going to occupy. We're just going in, doing a bit of a mission for maybe a few weeks or a few months, and then we're going to leave, which is not really an occupation. So we're starting to play with words at the Security Council resolution, which does show you the total disrespect of the Ministry of Defence and the other NATO allies for the UN Charter, for the institution of the Security Council. And actually, let's not forget that this is just the Security Council. This has not been voted on, as far as I know anyway, by the General Assembly of the United Nations, which is all the nations of the world. This is just the richest and most powerful nations, the old superpowers, really, post-World War II, that have voted on this. And it has not been approved by the General Assembly of the United Nations, which is all of the countries of the world. So, you know, what we're doing here is we're starting to really ride roughshod over the rule of international law. And goodness knows what the consequences will be. I'll tell you what I think the consequences will be, is a protracted bloodbath. And I may be cynical, but this is the kind of thing which has actually started going on in Pakistan. Mm. It's been going on in Afghanistan, clearly. I mean, with those awful pictures that we saw a couple of weeks ago,
yes,
in Rolling Stone magazine and Die Zeit, Bild Zeitung, which is a German paper, showing, you know, young children being, because of the American soldiers are bored in Afghanistan, then rounding up young children and murdering them, assassinating them, because they have nothing to do and just for so-called fun. This, I'm afraid, is what is likely to eventually happen too in Libya, where a protracted, what is said, you know, that we're sold the lie that it's going to be a quick intervention to help humanitarians and to help civilians.
But I mean,
can last for years. Mm. And I think certainly we've got all the ingredients in Libya for that, because as the West starts to break international law and move occupying forces in to do all sorts of more interventions rather than what it says in the UN resolution, this drives more and more of the Libyan people, as I said before, onto the side of Gaddafi. So then that will make sure that the conflict lasts longer and longer and longer. The more pressure that the West puts on to the rebel side, the more the Libyan people and other people from around the Arab world are going to go on to Gaddafi's side. I actually think this is part of their plan. I don't think they really want peace in Libya.
No, I do have to say I do agree with that. And as I said to you, after the declaration last week about how the main Western intervention force, UK, France, and the United States, and they all now said they're not going to come out of Libya and they're going to continue to bomb Libya until Gaddafi actually goes. Whereas on the other hand, they reported that Gaddafi has been defiant and saying he's not going to go.
Under international law, say they have absolutely no right to do that.
No, they don't. I mean, if we look at the United Nations resolution, they were actually there to intervene and stop Gaddafi from massacring his own people. Now, from massacring his own people, we are actually now moving on to the next level, where we're actually going to, in effect, occupy Libya, just as we've done Iraq, just as we've done Afghanistan.
Now,
I have been, by the way, guys, I have been sort of polishing my fingernails slightly on my sweater, because I must say, on the show, after all this happened at the weekend, around about, was it the 19th, I think, of March, we had a report on Friday Drive Time on our Bristol show, explaining from a guy who was born in Libya, who lives in Bristol, who'd been on the phone to Libya, explaining that he was really angry with these initial Al Jazeera reports. And now we've heard this week, officially in the British press, yes, actually these Al Jazeera reports of Gaddafi attacking his own people never happened.
Indeed,
so what happens is, in these sorts of situations, I think, and I was at the Journalist Union conference the other weekend, chatting with other journalists about the whole Libya conflict, particularly there was a sort of group associated with Stop the War in London, including writers on the Financial Times, etc. And we were all in one agreement on this, that this is one of the biggest media wars we've ever seen, where disinformation, lies, simply being spieled out to the public in order to provide a cover for essentially war crimes.
Now, well, I'm listening.
We're moving into a new era, and I think this is one of the reasons why some of the Chinese and Russian commentators have been so outspoken against what the West is doing.
Well, they've been very sensible, and I think, you know, is it classic propaganda, so to speak? You know, from the sort of, kind of like the World War era is kind of rearing its ugly head again.
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, the thing is, at least in the past, I know our coverage of various conflicts, things like the Vietnam conflict, etc., in this country, were reasonably balanced. I think it's almost got unhinged with Libya, and we're not getting both sides. But I think also there's a positive side to all this, and that is that we are living in a bit of a media bubble in the NATO zone. Let's say. I mean, I think also in Europe the media is a little bit more balanced. In the US and the UK, we're not really being given the same news as other people are in our newspapers. But, you know, the media nowadays is much more global. And so, for a start, many people in other parts of the world are very sceptical about Libya, whereas maybe a few people that just watch the BBC News and nothing else aren't. And also, of course, the media nowadays, satellite media and the internet, gives us access to views and opinions, facts that maybe we didn't know, and
even
evidence.
Good old shortwave radio.
I mean, essentially, television is an evidence provider. What it does is it gets evidence and it puts it into our living rooms and shows us. It's just that what's been happening in Britain is largely one-sided.
And also to mention that also we have shortwave radio as well. I mean, I've been listening to Dan Roberts' shortwave radio report for a few weeks now.
I'm not sure how many of our listeners in Birmingham have got shortwave radios in their house, though.
Well, that's true.
I still have one, actually. I used to be, you know, just digressing from the what we're talking about, I want to tell you a little bit about a little thing about myself. You know, I was going through a phase, actually, in my colleges, where I was into collecting all different kind of radios. And in amongst my collection, when I looked at the other day, I found a couple of shortwave receivers.
Well, we are getting close to the break, but this particular thing, we played a clip for earlier, the shortwave report, is something I'm going to give you a little endorsement here on Unity FM. You can actually go online, and if you go to outfarpress.com, every Friday, a short half an hour, kind of like a collation of various newscasts from stations in Russia, China, Japan, Germany, as Germany as well, and Cuba, of all places, Cuba as well, Radio Havana, Cuba.
I think Dan Roberts does a fantastic job with that shortwave report. It's one of those, you know, anybody that's really canny with their MP3 player gets that every week and listens to it at some point, maybe cycling into work or whatever, because it's such a brilliant roundup of what's going on. And it comes from, not from the sort of massive multinational corporations, it comes from a guy called Dan who lives in a solar-powered shack in western United States, out in the woods. And it's all run on things like, you know, very, very simply, on power from solar panels.
He's off the grid.
He's off the grid completely.
And the news you get.
You know, I think it's great to give him a bit of an endorsement, because I've been listening on and off to his show and using clips from it for quite a while now. And, you know, he's the sort of guy that is one of the little people in the media world, but actually he shows.
Just hold on to that thought, Tony. We are very we're thick as
imminence
away from a commercial break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM with myself, Tariq, Saeed, Tariq Humayun, and Tony, of course. We are back after the break.
Talking about Tesco. Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Assalamu alaikum, this is Jasmine, and I'm a Muslim Scouser from up north. When I'm not watching Liverpool Football Club, I listen to 93.5 Unity FM.
A particular concern is food prices. This is the biggest threat today to the world's poor, where we risk losing a generation. We are one shock away from a full-blown crisis. The financial crisis taught us that prevention is better than cure. We cannot afford to forget that lesson.
93.5 Unity FM, you are listening to Behind the Headlines. It's Tuesday, just after 9:30, today the 19th of April 2011. We are actually in conversation with Tony Gosling. If we got a bit of time, actually, for our listeners, for the benefit of our listeners as well, and for ourselves, I'd like to actually discuss the upcoming referendum with Tony a little bit.
Well, before we do, let's just mention that clip we played, just so we're giving people a complete confusion. That was the president of the World Bank, that's Robert Zoellick, okay? He is saying that we are one shock from crisis, basically. That's a report from the BBC. The president of the World Bank has warned that the world is one shock away from a full-blown crisis. He has cited rising food prices as the main threat to poor nations who risk losing a generation. And he was speaking in Washington at the end of the spring meetings of the World Bank and the IMF, okay?
Now, that's rather alarming. I mean, if the leader of the World Bank is actually saying that, and this, again, been reported in the BBC.
He also says the crisis in the Middle East and North Africa underscores how we need to put the conclusions from our latest World Development Report into practice. Wonder what he means by that.
Well, Robert Zoellick, of course, is, you know, the World Bank and everything they represent nowadays. These people are like international gangsters. They are, as Max Kaiser is quite regularly saying on his Kaiser report, financial terrorists, because they've hijacked our means of exchange. These people are hijackers. Yeah, that the means of exchange, you know, our money system is there. It should be there anyway to serve the people, to serve the needs of ordinary people, so that it's easy for us to move goods and services around the world to provide for those in need. That's what money is there for. What's happened is these people have hijacked it, and they're now using it as a, basically as a tool to manipulate people.
Well, you're right there, Tony. I mean, he's actually said.
Zoellick, as well, is a, one of the key members of the Bilderberg conferences, which I've got a website about. The website address is bilderberg.org, and I've been researching these Bilderbergers for many years now. The Bilderberg is really the place where most of the money in the Western world is represented. The trouble is that there are a load of politicians that go along to these meetings, secret meetings as well. People like Kenneth Clark and various other British, I mean, Peter Mandelson is another one. And George Osborne has been to these meetings. And there's a great, I mean, I would really suggest that this is a kind of a cult, a Western cult, a secrecy cult around money. And this is part of the problem, isn't it? That money really should be there to serve people, and yet a bunch of people have hijacked it, and they're now using the money system like a gun to the head of the politicians around Europe and saying, you're going to have another bailout now.
Well, one of the interesting things, Tony,
in a way, is responsible for the very situation, which he seems to be saying is, oh, isn't this a pity, isn't this a shame, and isn't it dreadful? But actually, he is the guy responsible for it. In any kind of sensible world, we would be thinking about, well, okay, well, what we need to do here is we need to actually change the money system, forgive the debt, etc., and make sure that we kickstart these various economies to work again. But it seems to me that these people are not interested in that, and they're not interested in us. All they're interested in is the power that they can keep and gain through the secrecy involved in the way the world's money system operates, and the private banks, the private banking system. I mean, this is the irony of the World Bank and places like this are not actually run in the interest of ordinary people. They're run in the interest of the member banks and private banks. I mean, the bankers really are the boogeymen of the moment, aren't they?
They are indeed. Well, the devil's in the detail of this report, and one of the things that's in this report from the BBC is that G20 meeting in Washington, the financial chiefs there have pledged financial support to help new governments in the Middle East and North Africa. You could read into that what you want, really, but that's very interesting. Why would they want to fund these new governments, sir? For democracy, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I think quite a lot of the time, these, you know, they haven't mentioned there whether this is a gift or a loan. You know, actually, when someone comes along knocking on your door saying, I've got a load of money here, the first question should be, right, well, what's the interest rate? Not thank you very much.
Well,
you
know, absolutely,
because,
absolutely.
Because essentially, what these the European Central Bank and the World Bank, as they go around to places like Ireland and Portugal, and they'll be back here soon as well, they're like loan sharks. You know, they're like the loan sharks on the council estate that goes around preying on vulnerable people.
I could have put any better myself, actually, but that is actually, you know, it's the way. And, you know, the thing is, this whole thing about food price rising, I mean, they've been talking about this. Well, I've come across a couple of reports, actually, about how food prices are going to rise, and the poorer countries for that are going to suffer. Now, I mean, the bankers...
Are they not already suffering?
Well,
of course they are,
but...
The difference is, I mean, it was all very well when the war on terror started, something far away. What's happening with this financial crisis is it's sort of starting to come home. I was in Wales at the weekend, in Ebbw Vale, which is a former mining community, and it is really so sad to see, you know, over half of the shops at one end of the town are just boarded up, and people are kind of walking around unemployed. It's like... there isn't any kind of vision now for where people are going to go in the future because the industry has been closed down.
You know, there's a despair, you know, in the air, isn't there? I mean, there's a kind of hopelessness.
It's our job, I think, because the politicians don't seem to be very good at it, it's our job to look for solutions. And one of the clear solutions is that there needs to be... I mean, this is one of the things which was mooted in the localism bill before the election, which is to allow local authorities to create their own banks and actually to start fueling development in the local economy.
Now,
what we need is we need jobs in this part of the city, or we need potentially anyway new industry in another part of the city, and that those banks can just start creating the money, given the permission by the Treasury. So, you know, this is the way I think that we need to move. The only trouble is, I'm afraid, I went through the localism bill is being discussed at the moment, and that clause seems to have been dropped. Now, it may be this is after the last year's election, because they were campaigning for this before May 2010. So it may be that this is something that the big banks, you know, the investment banks, people like Barclays and the rest of them have said, no, we can't have this. And that wouldn't at all surprise me. Policy on this.
How much influence did the big banks have, i.e., Barclays or RBS and people like that? I mean, if they had Lloyds, DSB, if they had influence on that, then you know, I mean, and it's sad to see some kind of a cause that would have been really, really good.
I think actually local authorities could be key in this. That, you know, local government could be, you know, the you know, these are the people that are obviously getting it in the neck now because of Westminster's and Osborne's austerity policies. A lot of local politicians are finding, well, look, we've got no, you know, we're having to make massive cuts. For example, the massive cuts they made in Manchester and in Birmingham. Birmingham was one of the first cities to lay people off. As these local politicians get it in the neck, I think it's about time that some of them woke up and said, right, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to be proactive in Birmingham. We're going to create a Birmingham bank, and we're going to start spending money into the Birmingham economy from the Birmingham bank. We're going to do just what these London city banks do, which is to create new money out of nowhere to fuel the economy and get things going. It's only we're not going to be spending it on arms or biotechnology, genetic engineering firms. We're going to be spending it on basic jobs and industry.
Perhaps we could start a little campaign here.
Well, we have a conversation with one of our city councillors here in Bristol, and they are apparently, the Liberal Democrat ruling group are considering the idea here in Bristol.
Well, if anyone out there is listening and you know, you want to get involved in this, basically, then I think, you know, we can put ourselves behind this, basically, and maybe launch an official Behind the Headlines campaign.
I think so, and I think it would benefit the local economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think it's going to be the way forward. I mean, we're in such an economic deep... Well, we're so deep in it at the moment, I won't...
Besides, you mentioned about economic...
We've got some fantastic resources out there in our very, very well-educated people, particularly our young people. It seems criminal to me that the jobs are not being provided, the workspaces are not being provided for our young people particularly. And of course, there's many, you know, older people who have lots and lots of skills who have had to take early retirement or whatever, and who would love to actually, even if it is work part-time.
But Syed, Tony, Humayun, gentlemen, isn't it nice to know that in all this economic difficulty and hardship, that Tesco's making a nice bit of profit. Well, I mean, you've got the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. Tesco profits. This is the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. Tesco profits rise despite UK weakness. Yep. This
from London. I think it's £3.5 billion they made.
Dow Jones grocery store giant Tesco PLC said Tuesday net profit rose 14% as strong growth in its international operation, modest profit at the company's UK business. Well, that's nice. Good old Tesco's doing okay, eh?
Well, of course. I mean, well, every little helps. Every little, you just told them the words that I'm on, yeah. Actually. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, though, actually, Tarek, and, and I'm not endorsing any company, but I've actually... been looking for a couple of items, and I've been looking at a few websites, and Tesco's, and the rest of the stores, and I've seen some comparisons, and I got to say, Tesco's are
by far the priciest.
Not priciest.
On cheapest, aren't they?
Cheapest, yes, they are. I have to say that.
Be careful that we're not too much of a ringing endorsement and advert for Tesco's. Right?
No, I hope not.
But I was going to say, the Tesco I go to costs a bomb.
Actually, Tarek, I mean, even the one I use, you use the same one as I do, of that franchise.
That's in Aston, yeah?
Yes.
24 hours.
Yeah, 24 hour one. And I got to say, a lot of the stuff I've actually been buying and have good quality stuff as well. It's been quite cheap.
So how is it working out that cheap? And we're in the middle of, we're hearing about food prices soaring across the world.
Exactly.
Somebody must be getting fleeced somewhere down the line.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, actually, what's going on here, Tesco's, all these kind of grocery retail businesses, even though, of course, they've diversified into lots of other things, are actually not highly profitable. So, in other words, we're just looking at the ratio of the profit to the turnover of Tesco's. I mean, there's all sorts of other reasons why big companies like Tesco's try and keep their profit down. It's because they don't have to pay for so much corporation tax then. So they spend lots of money on marketing and advertising, that kind of thing, which is kind of peripheral, really. Because that means that they then don't have to pay so much corporation tax. But the actual margin of profit to turnover is something like 5% in a business like Tesco's. So their turnover, I'm just checking some figures here, last year's turnover of Tesco's was $62 billion.
Wow.
And so, but only $3 billion or so of that was profit. So you can see it's not actually as
a huge amount.
Profit to turnover, it's not actually a massive amount.
So where did the $50 billion go then?
Well, it goes on purchasing the food.
Oh, I see.
And also on, I would imagine, building new Tesco's or whatever. We've got, actually, I was quite chuffed tonight to see on the BBC News, we had our Tesco's protest in Bristol here, on the BBC News this morning. There's a very controversial shop which is opened on Stokes Croft, which is a sort of arty quarter, I suppose, and creative quarter here in Bristol, where there was an occupation of the building by squatters. The Tesco's, at the beginning of last spring, actually, because they heard that Tesco's wanted to open a shop there, it was occupied by a load of people. And last spring, there was a whole day-long eviction, and it was the whole of the main A road that runs past it was closed, and there was something like 300-400 of the local residents came out to watch the whole thing, as the one by one, these various squatters were taken out of the building. And that has just literally opened in the last week or so as a Tesco. There's actually no parking, at all for people, and of course, it's actually on a main road, so this is really rather difficult, and there's now a protest camp outside that Tesco's permanently, and on the other side of the road as well, a big sign, anti-Tesco sign. So it certainly seems that the people of the arty quarter in Bristol are not happy about Tesco's opening there, because of course it means that the independent local businesses in the area are suffering immediately.
Well, I have to say, I mean, this is one of the things that are rather worrying. I mean, although Tesco's are sprouting sprouting all over the place, it did actually put in the...
Sorry to just interrupt you, I'm actually, I was doing some investigation myself on Tesco's, and they're building a new Tesco's in Birmingham, in Moseley Village. Moseley Village is known for, it's a village where everyone knows each other, and got a little independent shop selling organic food. And they're the big hoo-ha, a big protest as well among the shopkeepers. And I understand the stories, what you're saying, Tony, in Bristol.
Well, the way that this one here has been quite fascinating, because even, it was last spring, just think, it's nearly a year since these squatters were evicted from this potential Tesco site before they've actually opened. And all that time, Tesco's have been paying some dodgy-looking security firm to have two security guards permanently out of the front of the building and two permanently out of the back of the building. So imagine the amount of money that would have cost Tesco's for the last year, simply to have four security guards sitting there doing nothing for a year.
Well,
being squatted.
Well, absolutely. You know, just to mention another high street shop that's been doing quite well in this whole economic meltdown is the actually the Poundland stores. You know, I mean, I've watched a report at the end of last year, actually. Your biggest high street stores like M&S, well, they were doing poorly. Poundland's profits actually risen.
Well, that's because we're seeing a society dividing. It's almost like a cell dividing, isn't it? between the haves and the have-nots. You know, we're being slowly but surely, we're being pushed into the sort of situation of being a kind of third-world country, you know, where traditionally, I mean, I've traveled quite a lot in Latin America, and you see cities with a very rich quarter, but gated communities, actually usually high fences around the entire community, as well as around individual homes within that community, and the rest of the city is living in squalor, in ghettos, and literally, you know, sometimes without any utilities, where people are having to go to, you know, maybe you know, several quite a way down the road to actually get water to bring back to their home, and you know, I think there are a lot of people out there now listening who are actually worried about the way that their utility bills are all going up, whilst incomes are generally going down.
We're also being told things like
housing benefit is being cut. This is a new change which has been aimed particularly at disabled people. And we're moving into an era, I think, under this coalition government of a kind of dog-eat-dog, law-of-the-jungle style society where caring for the vulnerable is just out the window.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the disabled and the pensioners, I think, are going to suffer under this coalition.
The annoying thing is that it's all this kind of rubbish analysis saying that, oh, you know, we've got to pay this money back, we've got to have all these austerity measures. Bad economics, basically, is the driving force behind it. And I think will be very, very interesting to see in these local elections how the British public react to the last year of these austerity measures.
And now, talking of the local election,
we're not just having an election, we're having a referendum.
Absolutely, I was going to come on to that. Now, for those of us who are a bit confused, or we don't know, and I include myself in that, this referendum, what does it mean, and what is it all about, if you can break it down for us a little bit?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that this new AV type system is much better than the old system. Because it allows, you know, everybody who's voting to give the spread of opinion that they want. You don't have to, you can, if you want, use your vote like the old first past the post system, where you just give one preference for one candidate. But you're also able to write a number two, a number three, number four for other candidates that you quite like, but you didn't like quite as much as the first candidate. So what it does is it gives you a whole... Every individual has a choice whether they want to just put down number one for their preferred candidate and nobody else, or if they want to also have a second vote, if you want, for a second candidate. Because the way it works is the candidate who gets the least number of votes, as the count proceeds, that candidate is eliminated, and all of the second votes for that candidate are then added to the totals for the remaining candidates, until one candidate is a clear winner or gets 50% of the vote. It's actually, I think, a far, far better system than we've got, and it's also, it gets rid of this whole silly idea of tactical voting, where people vote for a candidate that they want to block somebody else, rather than for the candidate that they really want to get in.
Absolutely. Now, I understand it a little bit better. I think it's a fantastic idea, actually.
It's also interesting, all the rubbish that's been talked by the No campaign. I mean, it really is total codswallop, some of it. Saying, for example, that this is the preferred choice of the extremist party as well. I mean,
yes, I was going to come on to that. Actually, there have been talks about with this kind of with the AV that will give more rise to and more seats to the BNP section and the far right.
But I hate to say it. No, I mean, that's just not true. But I hate to say it. But you know, in a way, tinkering with the voting system is nowhere near as important as actually getting our economic health back in order. And it almost doesn't matter who gets in at the moment, whether it's any of the three main parties.
Well, absolutely.
Miliband has been talking about having cuts. Obviously, Clegg, you know, the guy is just sinking below the ice now. Incredibly.
Yeah, he's just a scapegoat, isn't he?
And I don't think many of these, I mean, either Cameron or Clegg, I don't think have got the interest of their party at all at heart.
Well,
they're in for a short-term profit, just like these, these crazy people at the City of London. They want short-term gain. They're not looking at the long-term at all.
Well, Vince Cable, actually, isn't the Telegraph today, has been trashing David Cameron. He's saying he's backing the AV campaign, and he's also said that he may resign and that he could actually dissolve the whole coalition as well.
Well, this may be an issue which really does split the two main parties. I can see that. Of course, one of the reasons that there's been all this disagreement recently is because this is the first issue on which the Conservatives and the Liberals as part of the coalition are totally, well, not entirely, but almost 100% split on this issue. The Liberals, for years and years, I mean, in a way, the only way that they got into this coalition is to get this referendum, because they quite rightly understand that it allows for a much broader spread of opinion amongst voters, and that smaller parties, like the Liberal Democrats, get cheated by the first-past-the-post system. I mean, particularly, the party that this is likely to, if the AV referendum is ultimately a yes vote, as I hope it is, the party that is going to benefit the most is probably the Green Party, because the Green Party comes sort of third, fourth or fifth in many elections across the country, and this is going to give them a little bit of a step up to actually get a bit more credibility and give them a few more MPs, possibly even in some parts of the country, because many people who would vote Green normally don't vote Green because they think, well, that's a wasted vote. I'm going to vote for somebody that actually might get in, yeah?
And I think that's with a lot of the voters, though. I mean, for these small parties who don't have enough recognition, they don't want to vote for them because the thinking goes behind it that if we vote for them, what can they actually do for us? And some for small parties, nothing really, because they just don't have enough power behind them.
And actually, well, the only part, I mean, it might sound crazy, but one of the only parties that's got a really sound economic vision for the future are the Greens. I mean,
yes,
they are actually talking now about, and they have been probably for the last 20, 25 years, about having a basic income that everybody gets, so that, you know, it's not as if everybody is fighting dog-eat-dog for the few jobs that are around. And to make sure that money comes into individuals' bank accounts and then is spent into the economy. This is immediately going to give the economy a bit of a boost. It's going to stop this ridiculous charade of applying, as I do, actually, for jobs week after week, you know, without actually any success, seeing that there's hardly any jobs there.
Yes, I know the feeling.
And the Greens are the only party who have a really good independent economic think tank as part of their party.
Mm. But I mean,
so hopefully that, you know, some of these ideas, you know, I think their day has come, because the main three parties, Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative, really haven't understood that there needs to be some fundamental economic rethinking if this country is to get back on its feet again.
But I mean, of course, we must mention we don't endorse any political parties at Unity FM.
No.
Obviously, these are the opinions of presenters and, you know, people involved in the show, but not necessarily the opinions of Unity FM itself.
That's right, and there are, of course, other parties standing in these local elections.
Of course,
but having said that, we're really here talking about the referendum and how it's likely to affect things. You know, I think it's been a real pity that parties like the Greens over the years have been constantly marginalised, because they have such a, you know, they don't have a lot of money to spend on marketing, and they found it very, very difficult to actually get their first MP.
This is something I've really felt strongly myself, Tony. I've got to say, you know, there's been a monopoly for far too long a time. Honestly, you've hit the nail on the head. These small parties, they don't stand a chance, and this is why people often just don't even vote for them, because they see them as being just nobodies, and it's not fair. That to me is not democracy.
But having said all this, right, I think it's also probably fair to say that if you've got too many little parties, everything gets rather difficult and confused.
Yes.
You know, I mean, actually,
that's the other side of it as well.
The Nazi Germany. That was one of the problems over there.
But I mean,
they had lots and lots of tiny parties, and nobody could really figure out, you know, what was the mainstream political opinion. So I think it's also, you know, you've got to get a sort of balance, I think, between having enough different ideas Because, you know, it really is a pity. What's going on with the Labour Party, I think, at the moment, is a problem, because you've got lots and lots of Labour Party members and supporters who don't want cuts, and yet you've got a Labour Party leader who stood up in Hyde Park saying that he thought there must be cuts.
Well, Tony, as ever, we have just come to the end of the show. Just quickly, tell us what's coming up on BCFM this Friday.
Well, this Friday, we're going to have quite a good discussion with a local MP, and then we've got something rather special, because it's Good Friday. We've got an interview with a chap who was actually born in Palestine. His father was a civil servant in the British administration of Palestine in the 1940s, and his mother was locally born and bred. And he has been following the conflict over many, many years, and he's got some very interesting things to say about some of the, what he sees anyway, as extremist views, which are very, very, very little known by most of us here in the West.
Well, I'll be listening to that for certain.
You can catch Tony and Martin on thisweek.org.uk.
Also, check out Dan Roberts every Friday as well, the shortwave report on outfarpress.com. Brilliant podcast, honestly. Get down your MP3 players. Fantastic.
If I've got 5 seconds, I'd love to plug last week's guest as well, Helen Caldicott, because she's a nuclear campaigner from Australia who came over to give us a really good bit of insight into the nuclear industry.
She is brilliant.
A real insight, in-depth look into what has actually been going on in Fukushima.
Have a listen. To that,
Check that out. You can go to, once again, I mentioned it, www.thisweek.org.uk, and you can download it from there and ensure to check it out.
And she's an Australian paediatrician who knows lots about leukemia, which is caused by cancer clusters around nuclear plants.
Tony Gosling, as ever, thank you very much for coming on, and we will be back with you just after 9 o'clock next Tuesday evening. Well, I just kind of lost for words then. This is the end of this week's edition of Behind the Headlines. You have been listening to it on 93.5 Unity FM in Birmingham and throughout the surrounding area. We will be back, of course, next week between 8 and 10 p.m. myself, Tariq and Humayun, and of course Tony and Martin. Up until then, we're going to go home now and enjoy the what's remaining of this lovely weather in this lovely evening. So hope you keep yourself well, safe, and because all my listeners, you know, for next week. So don't go doing anything that will actually jeopardize your safety. On that note, we'll see you next week. Same time, same place. A very good evening to you all. And if you've got little ones, give them a kiss. Give them a hug. Tell them you love them.